There are two chapters in the Bible to explain the history of the world from the aftermath of the great flood to the call of Abram. Just two chapters. It is a very long period of time to be dealt with in two chapters. I think it's well for us to remember as we come to these chapters that, as we have insisted all along in this series that we call Gospel Bedrock, we are dealing here with history. We're not dealing here with myth or with legend, but with history. The only way we know infallibly about this period is from the Scriptures of Truth. In these two chapters, we confront the sad chronicle of apostasy. The chronicle of the departure of those who are trained up in the way of truth from that truth toward that which is in error. It is a sad story. So extensive did that apostasy become ultimately that even in the family of Shem there were those, according to the testimony of Joshua, later on, who descended into idolatry. So we ought not to minimize the significance of what these chapters record. And we ought not to miss the lesson that they have for us concerning the way in which we hold the truth. Nothing was more appalling in the old world, the world before the flood, than the knowledge that there were descendants of Adam, the first man, who knew the truth of divine revelation, but who openly flouted that truth. And with malice went in the way of Cain. Nothing was more appalling in the new world after the flood than the knowledge that there were descendants of Noah, even while he was still living, who despised the truth that he proclaimed and who rose up against that truth. It was, we may be sure, no great surprise to Noah that such departures occurred. He understood, after all, far better than most, the history of the old world. He knew why it had developed as it had. And he knew that such history was likely to be written again in the world after the flood. Still, that there was any history written at all after the flood was the result of God's grace and mercy. His mercy to people born in sin, shaped in iniquity. And it's also the result of his purpose that could never be extinguished to bring his Redeemer into the world. And in all that we shall consider in these chapters, the gross departure from the truth that Noah preached, God would never permit that objective to be lost. The chapter from which we have read this evening presents to us not really a strict genealogy, but rather an overall history of the development of the human race after the flood. We find traced in this chapter the history of three family groups descending from each of Noah's three sons and their wives, who we remember had traveled with Noah and his wife on the ark. There would be stamped on each of those three sons the reality of God's grace that had preserved their lives. For as surely as Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, so his sons found that grace in the eyes of the Lord. And we may be sure that the message of that deliverance would be passed on to each grandchild of Noah, regardless of who his father was. Nevertheless, over the record of this history, as we have read, there is a very dark cloud. We find in this chapter a sinister figure mentioned in the narrative. He was a man who sought prominence, more prominence in the world than anyone had reason to expect to have. He was not content to live in a humble fashion. He desired to receive from others the adulation. And he determined to rule over others, whatever the cost of that rule would prove to be. The actual timing of the events in this history is a little uncertain. In fact, when we come into these two chapters, there are a lot of questions regarding the chronology that have been debated among the commentators, and I'm not sure that we can come to any definitive statement about those issues. We're not going to deal with them this evening. But the problem in chapter 10 is we don't have the years given for the families of Japheth and of Ham, as we do in chapter 11, to which we will come in due course, for the family of Shem. There are questions as well over the relationship of the content in chapter 11, specifically the content dealing with the tower that was attempted to be built, to the history that is laid out in chapter 10. Was the Tower of Babel, or Babel as some say, was that incident part of the history in chapter 10? Well, some people point to the reference in chapter 10 in verse 25, to the earth being divided in the days of Peleg, as being a reference to the division that took place in the aftermath of the Tower of Babel. And then there is also, in chapter 10, the statement in verse 5, everyone after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. So that it could be that this history is comprehending far more than simply a direct chronology. It's a summary, if you will, of all these events, of which the tower, the building of the tower, is but one. I don't want to deal with the tower tonight. There are a lot of interesting things about that incident that we will come to in due course. But for our purposes, in dealing with the first part of chapter 10, all with which we need to be concerned is the emergence of the man who is called here Nimrod. He was, we are told, the son of Cush, the grandson of Ham, and the great-grandson of Noah. that Nimrod was born while Noah was still living is self-evident if you will just compare the length of generations in the family of Shem in chapter 11. And you will find that really to reach the second generation only took about 60 years or so, maybe a little more. Noah, we found last week, lived for 350 years after the flood. Shem's son, Arphaxad, his first son, or the son who is mentioned in the genealogy, was born 2 years after the flood. We're told in chapter 11. So it's reasonable to conclude that the first of Ham's sons was born around the same time, and that Nimrod, wherever he came in the list, since we are not necessarily being given here an order of birth in chapter 10, but Nimrod would have come at some point in the generations after that. But it is with this great grandson of Noah, Nimrod, that the biblical narrative is especially concerned. The name Nimrod comes from the Hebrew root that means to rebel. Literally, Nimrod is a noun form of that Hebrew root, and the name means the rebel. Now, the name Nimrod is full of such significance in that context that this designation has been given to others during the course of history, whatever their given names have been, others who have been associated, especially in a malignant way, with revolt against the truth. They have been called Nimrods. Nimrod is the first figure in the world after the flood to be associated with a kingdom. He had a kingdom over which he reigned. And we may be certain that he developed his kingdom as part of a grand scheme to depart and to teach others also to depart from submission to the rule of God. And there's evidence, to which we will come in due course, in a lot of the ancient writings, that Nimrod held God himself to blame for the flood that had so recently destroyed the world. The departure from submission to the rule of God was a departure that Nimrod was prepared to impose on others by the force of law, or, if necessary, by the force of arms. And so very quickly after the beginning of the world's repopulation, within just two generations, there was the same ominous history beginning to sprout in the earth. In these verses this evening, we confront the sobering reality of rebellion's reappearance. Now, you may be sure that in terms of human civilization, everything perverse finds its roots in the actions of Nimrod, the son of Cush. His emergence is a reminder to us that wherever the Lord God of heaven asserts his purposes in the world and propels forward the great plan of redemption, the devil will be out with all his malicious forces to oppose that purpose. To be sure, rebellion has its ultimate roots in the fall and the apostasy of Adam in the Garden of Eden. That rebellion, we are certain, lies in every depraved soul. Rebellion is bred into the heart. You don't believe it, ask a parent. And you'll get an education very quickly in how that rebellion is bred in the heart And that rebellion waits only the right circumstances to spring forth, the removal of restraint or the opportunity to assert oneself. But in an organized fashion, and that's what I mean when I speak about civilization, rebellion requires a man with a malevolent purpose to enslave others to his will. And in the context of this chapter, it is clear, and here's the point I want to make, rebellion is always religious in nature. Now, I don't say that necessarily in a positive sense, as I will illustrate here. But rebellion is in a religious context. This rebellion that Nimrod led was a rebellion against Jehovah. It was a rebellion against God. And I submit to you that every rebellion is in that setting. Nothing could have been farther from the truth than the idea that the Bolshevik Revolution that helped the Russians of 1917 to exchange one form of misery for another that was far worse. Nothing could be farther from the truth than that the Bolsheviks proclaimed that this rebellion was the enemy of religion. Bolshevism, and I'm speaking of that form of Marxist communism that was championed by Lenin, was its own religion. And if I had the time this evening, I could go through and document all of the evidences of that truth. The movement that Nimrod led was also its own religion. Now, the glorious thing about the passage that we have read this evening, and it's hard sometimes when you first read it to find anything glorious in it, is that there is going to come a day, as there already has for Nimrod, when the Nimrods of this world will be brought into final judgment. I hate to think that there may be anybody in this gathering who would fall into that category. But let us remember the truth that Nimrod, like all the other descendants of Noah, was brought up to know what the truth was and deliberately turned against it. There's going to come a day when Christ will have the final say on this Nimrod and on all the others who have followed in his train. This passage then has a dark cloud over it, but that cloud never blots out the purpose of the Creator. Not Nimrod himself could derail the purpose of the Creator. Now, I want us, when we look at this passage this evening, to observe three things in particular. The first two are most encouraging, I find. The third is most full of warning. First, confidence in God. This chapter is a statement of confidence in God. Notice verse 1 of chapter 10 and the words at the end of the verse. And unto them were sons born after the flood. Unto them were sons born after the flood. Now, the question as to whether or not these sons of Noah had produced any offspring before the flood is left unanswered. It would seem that perhaps they did not. But that is not anything we can know for certain. But if they had, those offspring were themselves swallowed up in the devastation. But let us think about this fact, that Shem and Ham and Japheth and their wives had just lived through the great cataclysm of the worldwide flood. They had witnessed in their growing up years, for we read here that Shem in chapter 11 was 100 years old when his son Arphaxad was born. So that in all the time that Shem was growing up, what was his father engaged in doing? His father was engaged in preaching and in building the ark. So all during that time leading up to the judgment of the flood, they were witnesses of all the preparation, and then they were witnesses of the devastation itself. When everything outside the ark that was a person or a land animal died. Not one was left alive. Now, the fresh reality of that event must have given any prospective parent pause. What if it should happen again? What if you begin to raise a family and then the judgment on the world happens again? Should they bring children into a world? Have you not heard this very line of reasoning so often in this generation? Should they bring children into a world that was still showing the dramatic effects of that judgment of God? The upheavals in the earth's climate? The volcanism that was still going on all over the world? The violent storms and all of that that was happening? Should they bring children into a world like that? But the sons of Noah had faith in God. There's something very interesting in chapter 9, something that tends to be passed over. But I would have you to notice it in verse 8. Or let's look at verse 7. And you, be ye fruitful and multiply. Bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. There was God's command. Notice verse 8. And God spake unto Noah and to his sons with him and to his sons with him, saying, And I, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you and with every living creature that is with you, of the fowl, of the cattle, and of every beast of the earth with you, from all that go out of the ark to every beast of the earth. And I will establish my covenant with you, neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of a flood, neither shall there any more be a flood to destroy the earth. And then we have the portion dealing with the rainbow that we considered when we were dealing with this passage. But notice that word that was given to the sons. This is not only a word for Noah, but for the sons. This is my promise to you. So for these sons of Noah, with their wives then, to produce offspring, indicated that they had confidence in that which God had promised. The births of those sons was a testimony to their confidence in that promise. And could I just say that confidence in God's promise is witnessed afresh in the birth of every child into the families of God's people. The people of God know that the world in which they raise their families is wicked. They know it is perverse. And they probably think it is more perverse than it has ever been. And the scriptures indicate that the world will become worse and worse. That's a condition of the last days, from the ascension of Christ unto the coming of Christ. The people of God know that. And so when they hear that line of reasoning, that question, should they bring children into such a world, they respond by saying, we believe God. Yes, the world is bad. Shem and Ham and Japheth could say the same thing. They knew that ultimately the world would be rotten again, but they believed God. So there is every reason for us to believe God. That, I believe, is the significance of that statement that unto them were sons born after the flood. It's going to be as God has said. But there's something else here in this passage that I find very encouraging. And that is the second thing I observe, distinctions of grace. Now, in the larger context of this chapter, and we did not read the entire chapter, but we will get through the chapter as we go along. But in this chapter and in the larger context, we find a difference that is made between the descendants of each of Noah's sons. The chapter begins with the descendants of Japheth, and it ends with the descendants of Shem. The descendants of Japheth, and the history of them takes up just the first five verses of the chapter. Really, it's a very basic overview. We really don't hear a lot about any one of these people, except that they lived. And we find out about them in chapter 5 that these were the ancestors of the Gentile people in the world. I dare say for most people in this gathering, you would find your ancestors in this list at the beginning of chapter 10 of Genesis. So the sons of Japheth were the ancestors of the Gentile people, and it is as though they're passed over very quickly. And then we come to the sons of Ham, to which more attention is paid. The sons of Ham were the ancestors of the people who settled in Africa and in many parts of Asia. And then at the end of the chapter, the sons of Shem. Now the sons of Shem are important because it was through Shem that the Redeemer would come. And here was the distinction that is made not only in chapter 10, but also in chapter 11 and beginning at verse 10. These are the generations of Shem. It is as though after that point, the concern with the sons of Japheth and the sons of Ham is over. And now there is a focus on the sons of Shem. And what is responsible for that distinction? Why is so much attention paid to the sons of Shem? Why were the descendants of Shem singled out in comparison to the other sons of Noah? Is this fair? Why aren't the others given as much attention? Well, I tell you that the sons of Shem are singled out because, and this is the only reason, of the sovereign and gracious purpose of God. That is what I mean by distinctions of grace. God singled out the sons of Shem, not because of how great they were, because Shem and Ham and Japheth were on equal footing in the ark. So it wasn't because of how great Shem was. It wasn't because of something that Shem represented that was superior to that which was represented in Japheth and in Ham. It was simply because God purposed to single them out. So even in the history of Genesis 10, where most people would probably be convinced they're not going to find anything dealing with the great doctrines of the gospel, even here we come to face the reality of God's mercy. God singled out the descendants of Shem and purposed that through them would come ultimately the Redeemer. And what do we learn? We learn that there is no cause for hope except in the mercy of God. That was ultimately the bastion to which every descendant of Shem had to retreat. And even when it came to Abraham, down the line, a number of generations, when it came to Abraham, where did he find his comfort and his encouragement? In the grace of God. But let us now come, thirdly, in this text, to this other element, which I say is full of warning. And that is what I call pollution of pride. Pollution of pride. Against the backdrop of grace, we find this man called Nimrod. We see in verse 8 that he began to be a mighty one in the earth, and the force of that is that here is what he desired. He wanted people to notice him. He wanted people to give attention to him, to applaud him, to commend him, to be a mighty one in the earth. He harbored ambition. Here was the really one of the earliest instances in the world after the flood of one who wanted to be great, one who wanted to exercise dominion over others. Now, if we take the words of verse 9 literally, it would appear that he developed this reputation by his savagery in hunting animals. Now, animals were hunted in order that people could eat. It wasn't so much a matter of sport, it was a matter of survival. So it could be that this designation of him as a mighty hunter was because of that reputation, but it also could be that he was adept in pursuing people, hunting people, and enslaving them to his will, or intimidating them in some fashion so that he could extend his influence. Now, when we come to the end of verse 9, we find the words that suggest that in all that he did, Nimrod set himself to oppose Jehovah. Notice it is said of him, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, or literally in the face of the Lord. Against the Lord is the force of the expression. He was opposed to the Lord. It's interesting that Josephus has a commentary dealing with Nimrod in his history. Josephus was a historian who lived around the time of Christ and has written a history of the Jewish people. And he says concerning Nimrod, "Now it was Nimrod who excited them to such an affront and contempt of God. He was the grandson of Ham, the son of Noah, a bold man and of great strength of hand. He persuaded them not to ascribe it to God, as if it were through his means they were happy, but to believe that it was their own courage which procured that happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God but to bring them into a constant dependence upon his own power. He also said he would be revenged on God if he should have a mind to drown the world again, for that he would build a tower too high for the waters to be able to reach, and that he would avenge himself on God for destroying their forefathers." That is what Josephus has to say about Nimrod in his Antiquities. And you will see the reason that some believe that Nimrod was involved in the project to build the Tower of Babel. The idea that he was going to get revenge on God for destroying their forefathers. The idea that he was going to create a structure so that if a flood came again, there would be a way to survive it. That was the force of the tower. It was not a tower necessarily like you would see in a story like Jack and the Beanstalk, a tower that goes way, way up into the atmosphere, but it was a tower that had sufficient elevation that it could get up above floodwaters. Now, whether Nimrod was personally involved in that project or not is something that is not known with any certainty. We'll have more to say about that as we go along. But certainly his spirit was represented in that project. We read of him in verse 10 of this chapter that he established a kingdom that began at Babel. And remember that that place took its name from the aftermath of God's judgment upon the building of the tower. His kingdom began at Babel and stretched across a large area of that part of the world. And by the way, that area of the world where these places were, of which we read here, is now the battlefield called Iraq. In fact, I was just reading yesterday, I think, that the city of Mosul, which is so much in the news, in the north of Iraq, is not very far from the ruins of Nineveh, the ancient city that is mentioned in verse 11, built by Asshur, the father of the Assyrians. That was the kingdom that Nimrod established. And the purpose of the kingdom was to defy God's truth, to organize opposition among men against the truth of God, and to provide means by which that rebellion could be spread in the earth. That was the ambition of Nimrod. The amazing thing about Nimrod is that aside from this reference, his name occurs in only three other verses in the Bible. And I think that that is an inspired commentary upon Nimrod by the Holy Spirit. Here's this man who was so ambitious, wanted people to notice him. And how many times is he mentioned in the Bible? Here is the fullest of the four mentions. In the other places, it's just his name. One of them is in 1 Chronicles. Two of the four references are here in this very passage. One is in 1 Chronicles and one in the prophets, speaking of the land of Nimrod. So here is one who wanted adulation, and what God did was to restrict the mention of his name. So Nimrod was in rebellion, but his rebellion could not continue, and he himself would be brought to account before God. The great theme that this passage sets before us is that rebellion reappears in the earth. And all through the earth since that time, rebellion has been cloaked in the language of revolt against the truth. It was a religious revolt here, and that religious revolt has never ceased since that time. It is still going on. The hatred of God, the hatred for His Word, the resolve to wipe His Word, if possible, from the conscience of the human race, that revolt had its roots in what Nimrod did. And yet, as I said at the beginning, the great encouragement about this passage is that God is still in control. And Nimrod, for all the efforts he made to plant the seeds of rebellion and to spread it abroad in the earth, Nimrod could not establish and consolidate it. He had a great kingdom, but Nimrod died. as did everybody else in this period of time. He died. Where he's buried, no one knows. The English romantic poet Shelley wrote a poem about a man named Ozymandias, whose statue had been discovered in ruins in the sands of a Middle Eastern desert. And on the pedestal of the statue, there were just fragments of the statue lying about in the sand, but on the pedestal were the words, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." That was the spirit of Nimrod. But the poet's commentary was that nothing beside remained. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sand stretched far away. What were the works that he had done? What was the work that Nimrod had done? There's nothing left of it. And what's the message? The message is, don't look to the Nimrods of the world. Look to Christ, who is the true King. Submit yourself to Him. Trust in His Word. Submit yourself to His authority. And then, however rebellion reappears, you will know that you will be on the side of those who will be vindicated on the day of judgment. Nimrod was a mighty hunter against the Lord, but the Lord eventually made Nimrod his prey and brought him to judgment. And so shall he do for every rebel against the truth.